Steve, go ahead.
Did Samuel Shoemaker, after he went back to Bookman and told him that he was right and everything, is that when he got into the Oxford group, or is that?
Well, they didn't really call it that then.
Not yet. Leslie Weatherhead is going to become very famous. Oh, good Lord, 20-30 titles. How Can I Find God? Weatherhead is going to come along much later after the Oxford group is long gone off the scene, but he's going to consistently credit his popularity because he has some very basic principles, kept it real simple. How can I find God? And this is an excellent description. The Oxford group method of finding God. A lot of this is it's in AA all over the place. Let's bring Bookman back from China now. He's going to get an offer from the Hartford Theological Seminary to come back to Hartford Seminary and get reinvolved with them. They offer him a very lucrative deal. Before he really actually starts his Oxford group, see, he had a teaching position there at Hartford Theological Seminary. And this leave of absence was from Hartford was the time that he spent in China. And that's when he changed. This is a term he's going to start using. Changed. Life
instead
changed.
Of conversions.
Yeah. Bookman picked up on the try and get religious terms out of this. It turns people off. Of course, AA and Bill Wilson was the master of, you know, we're not talking about character defects. We're not talking about sins here. Okay. It was during this change of Sam Shoemaker while they were missionaries over there. And these two guys, Bookman and Shoemaker, are going to become the two major leaders of the Oxford group. Bookman returned, and then he accepted a very generous offer. And here's a quote from the book there that Mel's got in his hand right now.
This is the most recent biography of Bookman.
On the Tale of a Comet. The arrangement was a generous one. It gave Bookman freedom to travel for 9 months in the year and only required him to give a series of lectures on the how of personal evangelism. While over in China, Bookman had picked up some very precise methods, and he knew that they worked, had kind of perfected them. The personal evangelism, how you dig in there and bring Christ to the life of it. This flyer is from one of those classes during that period. Says, Introducing Men to Christ, a class in personal work, led by Mr. Frank Bookman of the Hartford Theological Seminary, who lately returned from special work in India and China. Mr. Bookman is now with the Billy Sunday Committee. Wednesday nights in March, Social Parlor, Westside YMCA, 8 o'clock. He also had more, this is kind of a pass them out, get them all to come kind of a thing, but he also discovered another method, which is going to turn into what the Oxford group called the house party. Personal invitations of people you've run across recently, you can sense their life needs to be changed, and kind of what we're doing here today, just friends together, and this is an official invitation. You are invited to attend a series of talks at the residence. He also picked up on this. We're going to do it in people's homes, meetings, if people already started here. Mr. William Wolverton, 180 West 50th Street, on the mornings of March 23rd, 24th, 25th, and 11 o'clock, Mr. Frank N.D. Bookman will speak.
In the 20s here. And they at first were called the First Century Christian Fellowship. And then in 1928, through that meetings down in South Africa, as George explained, they acquired the name Oxford Group, and that survived until 1938. That was the official, for 10 years they used that name, the Oxford Group. And by that time, they were getting a lot of national publicity. You can look in the old reader's guides, and you can find references to Frank Bookman and the Oxford Group and so on. So they were pretty well known by the early 30s, and they were quite successful with their approach, but they were also controversial. And Bookman, for example, went to Princeton University and had some meetings on the campus, And apparently the faculty, the administration at Princeton didn't like some of the discussions going on in these meetings. But he got banned from the campus at Princeton.
Well, they were young men.
Yeah, and they were...
Sex is going to be a big topic in the lives of young men at that time. Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA. You can bet you there's going to be a lot of controversy when you get to witnessing and confessing what your problems at this point in your life are. Yeah, in that time period, you bet you they're going to crucify you.
And the campuses were much different in the 20s than they are today. You know, today they'd be talking about relationships and everything
Significant others.
Co-ed dorms and all of that, but that wasn't the 1920s. It was completely different in those days. But Bookman was an honest guy, and he believed in facing things honestly, and so sometimes it got him into trouble. He had another quality, was that he liked to associate with prominent people, and he loved to travel. Those were two of his characteristics. And, of course, it worked in well with his work in the Oxford Group because he went all over the world. And I read in one book that, and he was always trying to change prominent people. He had felt that he had learned at Penn State that if you change the captain of the football team, then all the other people come along. That you get the popular guy on the campus, get him changed, and the other people come along. They called that the key person strategy. The Oxford Group. And I feel, can't prove this, but I feel that if a group of Oxford groupers came to town and there was some prominent person there, they would devote more time to him than they would maybe just to the run-of-the-mill people. And now that's something that hasn't survived in AA. We don't really believe very much in the key person strategy. We have key people in AA, but the key people in the group might be a plumber down the street, you know. That's what we've discovered, that sometimes the prominent people turn out to be, you know, not very useful in AA. But that was their key person strategy, and it probably helped us in the beginning because of their work in Akron with the Firestones and stuff like that. But Frank Bookman did like to rub elbows with prominent people. He enjoyed that. Well, am I going to sit here and take his inventory? Yes. one book.
A lot of ego. You betcha. You see, he knew what he was on to. He knew his effectiveness. And, you know, ego may not, opinions here, may not be a bad thing. It's when we get into misusing it. If you feel you're directed and guided by God, they're going to split. Later on, way down the line. And one of the shoemakers going to say, I can't go along with this Oxford Group stuff anymore. I've got to take care of my church. He's going to kick Frank Bookman out. There's going to be a Frank and the Oxford Group going away. What Shoemaker, he's going to try a reconciliation with Bookman. And what he's going to run across is this. Bookman is going to, in effect, say, I am directed by God. I can't change. It's going to get bigger. I have the power behind me. You do your thing and bless you. I'm going to do my thing and God bless me.
You know, Bookman had a way of simplifying things. Although he was a trained minister and everything, he would use very simple language. And he had five C's which he advocated. And they were confidence. You gain somebody's confidence. Now in AA, you know, the big book, it talks about how one alcoholic can gain the confidence of another. And the second one was confession. And the third one was conviction. The person becomes convicted of his own faults or sins. And then conversion, the change, the spiritual change. And then finally, continuance. And continuance was carrying the message and all of this. Well, see, all of these things became incorporated in the 12 steps in one form or another. Continuance, we continued to follow this.
Sometimes that fifth C was called conservation. To keep, and you'll hear Joe and Charlie are real great. The first nine steps is how you become spiritually awakened, and the last three is how you keep it, how you maintain it, the conservation of it.
Well, they were very effective in the 30s with this small group idea, and that's where it was when the founders of AA came along. Now, there were two streams of Oxford group activity that fed into AA, and I'd like to just touch on both of them. The one was in New York, and Sam Shoemaker, as I said, had become the minister of Calvary Church in near Gramercy Park in New York. That's Sam Shoemaker. And remember, at this time in the 30s, he was a very devoted Oxford grouper.
And you can see his collar in it, that he's an Episcopalian minister.
Sam had a very successful ministerial career. He was at Calvary Church, I believe, 28 years, something like that. And then after he left Calvary, he went to another Calvary Church in Pittsburgh and spent the rest of his working career in Pittsburgh. I think he was there 10 years, and then he became ill and died a year or two later. But in the early part of his Pittsburgh experience, he was named Man of the Year in Pittsburgh, that sort of thing. He started a movement called the Pittsburgh Experiment in Pittsburgh, and it's still going today. And in fact, the minister who runs it is a close friend of a minister who lives right across the street from me and whose church I attend once in a while. So, anyway, getting back to the 30s, this was very active in New York. The meetings were at Calvary Church. They had a big room with 200 or 300 people at Calvary Church. It was called the Great Room. And that's where they had these Oxford group meetings. And that's where Bill Wilson eventually landed in this place. Well, Sam, another thing Sam did when he was at Calvary Church, they owned a building about a half a mile from the church. And Sam felt that they ought to have a mission. They ought to sponsor a mission for down-and-out people. And so he wound up getting in touch with a fellow named Harry Hadley. And Harry Hadley's father ran the Water Street Mission in New York. It's a famous mission that was started by a recovered drunk named Jerry McCauley. Jerry McCauley's Water Street Mission. And Hadley is one of the recovering alcoholics mentioned in the varieties of religious experience. But his son apparently went the same path and recovered in some way. And I'm not really sure if Harry Hadley was an alcoholic, but I think he was. But I wasn't able to pin that down. So I didn't say expressly in my book that he was. But he wanted to run a mission like his father had, and somehow he got in touch with Sam Shoemaker. And the Calvary Church owned this building over there, so they started this mission, Calvary Mission. And that ran from 1926 until 1936. And that's where Ebbie Thatcher was staying when he called on Bill Wilson at this mission.
This synchronicity here is...
It's just all over the place.
Before we go a little bit too further, they had literature. Again, their primary method of carrying this was the reading books and stuff. Here's what you would get when you first joined the Oxford group. After they got going and really caught on, they published their own stuff. It'll be sold out of Sam Shoemaker's Calvary Church here down in the basement. It's going to become the national headquarters kind of thing. You'd get this book. It was usually the first book ever given to Oxford groupers. It's a primer on the four absolutes that Mel told you about. And those four absolutes are still used. You go to a meeting in Akron today, you're going to hear about those four absolutes. Dr. Bob, he said, I used those all of my life. Anytime I had a question or a problem, I would run it by, and if it stood up pretty well to those four absolutes, then that was my guiding principles of life. Guidance from God, surrender, restitution, you'd call it amends, you know. Dr. Bob always was loaning out copies of this book. As a matter of fact, a copy of this book was found in a bookstore in Akron, Ohio, quite recently. When it was opened up, it said, personal property of, or something, please return to, something like that, Robert Holbrook Smith. That book is now sitting in Dr. Bob's restored house, in Dr. Bob's restored library. It didn't even make it out of Akron. He was passing those out all the time. Yep. What is the Oxford Group and an explanation of it?
Got Poor Sinners Only there.
A.J. Russell was a writer for the... here, some of their titles are just phenomenal. For Sinners Only.
1932.
This is another basic text. You get it early on. Tells the stories of many of the Oxford Group leaders, Frank Bookman, Sam Shoemaker. It also discusses and explains many of their principles and their practices. You want to go somewhere on that? Did you?
Russell, a lot of people came along and they were critical of the Oxford Group in the beginning. Now, Russell was a journalist. I think he set out in the beginning to write stuff that was going to be critical of the Oxford Group. Instead, he became one of their converts. And he wrote this great stuff, and For Sinners Only was published by Harper's in 1932. And I think that was one of the books also that influenced Bill Wilson when he sat down to write the big book. Because he contacted a Harper's editor, religion editor, and so on, and in the beginning. There's a lot of connection there. Yes, Bruce?
Question about For Sinners Only. Is it a stretch?
Well, that's possible.
It certainly would be an opinion that would have more... There's some basis there, yes. Personal witnessing was a big part of the religious scene of this day. So the story ideas for this that we use for Sinners Only... William James, the stories of the personal case histories, Mary Baker Eddy and her Christian side, the personal witnessing and story... to say that would be the only source, no, but a pattern is developed here early on. Russell also wrote this God Calling, a daily devotional. During this time period, anybody come up with a daily devotional, they were selling those like hotcakes. There was an unlimited market. People were buying them left and right. Russell wrote this God Calling. It's a daily devotional type thing for your morning meditation. That was something that was big in the Oxford Group, too, a quiet time in the morning.
Excuse me, may I interrupt here on
no.
this?
No.
Okay. Now, I was going to talk about this a little later, but Russell actually didn't write this. He says in the beginning, George, that he wished he had written it. Now, this book, God Calling, is important to AA because the meditations in it are in the 24-hour-a-day book. If you look in the beginning of the 24-hour-a-day book, it credits this book for the spiritual meditations. Each page in the 24-hour book has three sections. And the spiritual part of it is rewritten from this. And this has an amazing history. There were two women back in England back in about 1931 or 32 who were at the end of the road in their personal lives and just thought they couldn't go on. And so they started praying together, and working together, they started getting these inspirations. Singly, they couldn't seem to do it, but the two of them working together did. And so they wrote their thoughts down, and they called themselves Two Listeners. And today, we don't even know who they were. But somehow, this got into Russell's hands, and he edited it, and it came out around the 1935 or so in England, and I don't know if it was called God Calling then or Two Listeners, but it was published then in the 30s in England as an English version, and then in 1945 Dodd Mead picked it up and published it as God Calling, and it's had a very good sale, probably a 500,000 or so under that title.
So good that was for morning meditations. Russell then came up with this one, God at Eventide, for your, yeah. It's a companion volume to God Calling by Two Listeners, edited by A.J. Russell.
Now let me tell you another story of synchronicity. This is a personal story. I've got this 24-hour-a-day book here with the little gold medallion on the cover that is published by Hazelden. And, of course, the author of 24 Hours a Day was a fellow named Richmond Walker. He's been gone since 1965. But he was a tremendous guy, this Richmond Walker. And he was a drunk, and he was in the Oxford Group, around from 1938 or 39 until about 41. For 2 or 2.5 years, he was a member of the Oxford Group. He grew up in the Boston area. He came from a very wealthy family, and he was a graduate Phi Beta Kappa from Williams College, and he'd been captain of the football team there and everything else. But then he went into business with his brother in Boston and became a hopeless drunk. And so in 39, he got into the Oxford Group and stayed sober for 2 or 2.5 years, and he didn't even smoke then. He said he quit smoking for that, because the Oxford Group had a belief that if you didn't quit smoking, you probably would go back to drinking. And so then he went back to drinking, even though he had quit smoking. And he drank for about a year, maybe. And in 1942, he got into AA. And he stayed sober for the rest of his life and became a very good AA member. We have a talk by him on tape and everything. Well, a couple of years ago, yeah, here's a couple of his books that are published by Hazelden.
And he offered these for drunks only. This is his personal story of how you follow directions. He followed the directions in Chapter 5 of the Big Book, and this is his personal story about that. The 7 points of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then the 24-hour day book. He took A.J. Russell's stuff and reworked it and came up with this thing called the 24-hour day book. He offered, all three of these were offered to Bill Wilson to be published as official AA literature. Bill declined. His official reason was that, gee, if AA starts publishing these, then everybody's going to be on my front doorstep. He's going to have something that we ought to publish, and I don't want to hurt anybody. I'll just have to say no. There were some other reasons based upon content as well. So these then were offered, and Walker didn't want to make any money off this. He said, you know, free, have them, and royalties go to AA and everything, but it was still declined. So he took them to Hazelden. They started publishing it. It's still our major money maker today. And until AA came out with its daily reflections, but I couldn't hardly find a meeting anywhere where you didn't open her up with that 24-hour day book.
Let me continue with my synchronicity story.
Yes.
But anyway, are you going to stand there and hold those up in the air?
We need another sign.
I had become interested in, I remembered this book from the 1950s around Detroit. And when this book was introduced at AA meetings, it just caught on just right away. People just grabbed it and started using it. And at that time, it was published in Daytona Beach. And that's where Rich was living most of the year. And he had self-published this book in 1948, first came out with it. And then he mailed it out from his home and kept it in his basement and that kind of thing. And he knew he was getting along, so in 1954 he offered it to GSO, as George mentioned. They declined, and so Hazelden wasn't even in the publishing business. But they agreed, Pat Butler, who was the key guy at Hazelden, he agreed to take it over. And of course that got Hazelden into the publishing business. And they even have a new center at Hazelden today called the Rich Walker Center. It's named for him. And to date, this book has sold about 7 million copies. And I consider it the second most influential book in AA next to the Big Book. It's really had a great effect on AA. Well, we were in Orlando a couple of years ago for a Navy reunion, and we had Labor Day free. And my wife and I were there, and my wife's sister was with us, and we were wondering what to do on Labor Day. And I said I wanted to go up to Daytona Beach and see if I could find out anything more about Rich Walker. And then my sister-in-law had something up north of Daytona Beach she wanted to see, so we went up there. And I got in touch with a couple of old-timers. And one guy gave me a tape. He'd known Rich just a little bit. And he gave me a tape of a talk Rich had given in Rutland, Vermont in 1958 and some other information. And I collected as much as I could. And I remember on that trip, my sister-in-law, we had my sister-in-law's car, and we had a lot of tire trouble. And this guy, It was on Labor Day, and you couldn't even find a place open. And this guy drove us all over, drove me all over Daytona Beach to get that problem straightened out. And my sister-in-law was really impressed that a complete stranger would help us to that extent. Well, I would have done it for him in Toledo. You know, it's that kind of thing. It was AA. And so we went back home, and about 3 weeks later, now here's synchronicity. 3 weeks later, an editor from Hazelden called me up and said they were going to do a 40th anniversary edition of 24 Hours a Day. That's this one here. And they needed somebody to write the introduction, and he wanted to know if I knew anything about Rich Walker. And so I wrote this introduction. It's in there. And when they sent me the proofs, there was only one thing that I corrected. They didn't have my name on it, and I made them put my name on it.
Who was the guy that says, I don't mind if you misspell my name, just so long as you use it often?
Well, that's every Southern politician that ever lived. So anyway, there's that introduction. It's a little bit about Rich Walker's life story and anything. And this is a leather-bound edition. They sell it from Hazelden for $12 because it has leather binding and has this gold medallion on the cover and then this little red thing. But I just thought it was amazing. I didn't even know why I was going up to Daytona Beach. I just had that curiosity about Rich Walker. Mm-hmm. And then three or four weeks later, I get this call to write this introduction.
I kind of get back a little. We got some other Oxford Group literature. They didn't have, like we have, just one basic text. I've got a question, shoot.
Now, do you happen to know how much he sold the rights to the 24-hour book for?
Well, he gave it to him.
Yeah, the question was, how much did Richmond Walker sell the rights to Hayes, the copyright? Well, he gave it to them.
His idea was the
giving and sharing. And Hazel, it's still, of course, their bestseller today. So somebody told me that they make more off of the selling of the 24-hour day book than they do off of the treatment center of it. I don't know how true that is. That's an opinion, you know. But I use that to focus in on. It does make a lot of. Now, the Daily Reflection is going to cut into that a little bit, of course. But, well, anyway, back to some other literature they had. They had For Sinners Only, some really neat titles. Here's one. I Was a Pagan. And these guys were, drunks. Yeah, Victor Kitchen. He was on one of these teams of the Oxford Group. It's his personal before and after story, you know, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, of being conversion in the Oxford Group. It's a textbook. It's a fearless witness of uncompromising Christianity lived out in everyday life. Here's another one. Olive M. Jones, and this title is Inspired Youth. How they personally changed the lives of young people. Stephen Foote was another one. He published the book. And the Oxford groupers would share these and buy one, and I'll trade you this from that one, and recommend them to each other. It's a good account of the Oxford Group methods and practices. It's dedicated here in the front of it. It says, in gratitude and affection to that worldwide band of carefree, God-inspired men and women known as the Oxford Group. Life Began Yesterday by Stephen Foote. They got into publishing pamphlets. Here's one by J.P. Thornton Dewsbury, fellow of the Corpus Christi College, Oxford, entitled Sharing. Says, be honest about oneself, acknowledge your mistakes, confess your sins, explain what Christ did for you. This is to be done under guidance from God, and never betray another's confidence. When we talk about sharing today, it sometimes moves into, you know, let's dump all your stuff on the table. We can solve your problem by a little self-help, prop me up, psychobabble, you know. That's not the sharing that the Oxford Group was talking about. Personal witness. The Principles of the Group by Sherwood Sunderland Day. God guidance, fearless dealing with sin. That was what, big Franklin, fearless dealing with sin, really inventorying yourself. Sharing, intelligent expressional activities, stewardship, teamwork, and loyalty. Here's another one. This one isn't actually published by the Oxford Group. It comes out of Cleveland. The Cleveland Intergroup did this years ago, and they're still publishing it on the four absolutes, honesty, unselfishness, love, and purity. This pamphlet is actually printed they say it's by Alcoholics Anonymous, but the Cleveland Central Committee. It's an excellent description of the four absolutes as practiced by the Oxford Group. Bookman adopted these absolutes and used them as guidelines in his daily life. Shoemaker, the leader, he became the leader of the Oxford Group here in the United States. He often remarked that, he said, Bill Wilson made the remark, he said, we got away from those four absolutes because drunks aren't going to buy this idea of, you know, absolute this and that and the other. We need a little more lee room for these guys. That's too black. But Shoemaker points, that was not the idea behind these four absolutes. He says that they're something to shoot for. You're not going to be gained by a human being who is, by definition, imperfect. This is where you guide. You said they're not rules. They're rather to be considered as guidelines. Sailors, for instance, use the North Star for direction. Not that they ever expect to actually arrive at the North Star, okay? Shoemaker had a way of it. Oh, yeah. So the idea of Bill said, you know, well, these are too absolute. Bill didn't want the Oxford Group because of some negative things that were happening. He didn't want an association with them, and he used that, you know, drunks won't buy the absolutes, but that wasn't the purpose of the absolutes.
Tex, did you have something?
I wanted to ask about the Oxford, my understanding of the Oxford Group use of the absolutes was that it was a test. That the Oxford groupers, when they had a meeting, they sat around like the Quakers, waiting for the Spirit of God to move them to speak. And when Joe would talk, some of the, you know, people tend to be critical. That don't sound like Joe, or I sound more like Joe than does God, you know. And so I had some problems in this regard. So my idea of the absolutes was that this was developed as a test. If what came out of Joe's mouth was absolutely pure, absolutely honest, absolutely loving, and absolutely honest,
they had a thing, too, called the checking.
Yeah,
check with each other to see what message you got.
And my understanding was that it was to be used as a test for the authenticity of a leading rather than a model for your personal life.
Well, that was the idea. That was one way they used it. And any action you were thinking about taking or anything, you tested. You used it. Like the four-way test in the Rotary Club or whatever it is, you know, it's that kind of thing. They used it that way too. It was really the basis of their whole program, the four absolutes. But they did use it that way. Talking about that guidance, go ahead. Make a point.
The 24-hour group speaks of Christ, sees responsorship. Who was the originator of these?
The five C's.
Yeah.
Well, I think Bookman was, because he had a way of simplifying this. These were you here when I read these?
Yeah.
Confidence. Yeah, I think Bookman, and he had a lot of things like that. He may have been the one who developed using the slogans, even though those slogans are kind of old. But he liked to use slogans, so we probably got the slogans from Bookman too, even though they're old ones. You know, easy does it, first things first. It preceded, but he was the one who used it this way.
I've heard a few times that our 12 steps came from the original Oxford Group 6 steps and expanded them. That's not true. Bookman used a lot of the 5 C's the four absolutes. There was three S's or something. There was, but there was never a set of six of anything. And he liked, it was a catchy thing, and he liked slogans. Win your argument, lose your man. Give news, not views. It would catch on and people would hang on to it. But there weren't ever any six steps in the Oxford group.
I wanted to mention something about that guidance, because that was a big thing in the Oxford group, people getting guidance for other people. And that was one of the things Bill Wilson criticized later, that he didn't believe in that, that I can get guidance for what you should be doing, see. And Willard Hunter even told me that if you got guidance and then you went to Buchman, and your guidance didn't agree with his, he told you to go back and get more guidance. he even said that kind of humorously. But these two listeners, of course, were getting guidance when they wrote this book, see? So it worked in many cases. But Bill didn't like it, and he said he had been sober about a year in one letter or something, and some Oxford groupers came to him and said they had just received guidance that he should stop working with alcoholics. They had received that kind of guidance.
He wasn't maximum.
Yeah, they had a term that you're maximum when you're doing everything you should be doing. And they didn't feel that his specializing on alcoholics was maximum. And they got treated kind of badly. He and Lois talks about it in her book. And he didn't believe that they had received guidance. At least he didn't follow it. But they said, because they were annoyed with him, because he wasn't doing other things but just working with drunks. See, he wanted to specialize in just working with alcoholics. And they felt...
Yeah.
Wasn't there a Buchman quote, "I'm all for the drunk sobering up, that they're also drunken nations"?
That's right, and Willard Hunter gave us that.
Yeah, I'm all for helping drunks, but you got to understand, I have drunken nations on my hands. I got a cute story, though, about giving guidance for others. A fellow, he just got out of the treatment center, and it was fall, and he was all nervous and jumping, about to having a drink, you know what to do, and he came over to my house, "Oh, please save me," you know, and I was out in the front yard raking leaves at the time, you know, and so I went into the garage, and I grabbed a rake and gave it to him and said, "Rake leaves," and he said, "Why?" And I said, "I've received guidance from God," and he said, "Okay." He raked leaves all afternoon and didn't have a drink. You know, we still laugh about that today. Buchman gave speeches all over the world. He's on radio shows. He was a real headliner. They collected his speeches together in this book here, and the title of it is "Remaking the World." It's a collection of his speeches there. It demonstrates the distinct changes made when he reorganized this Oxford group into the thing called moral rearmament. We're going to move into the Oxford group, going to make some changes a little later. He had a number one assistant when he died. Actually, Peter Howard, the assistant, actually took over the movement. He worked with him for about 20 years. It's a detailed insider's view if you want to know something about the Oxford group. He tells how Buchman was transformed and the Keswick experience there, and then how Buchman went on and transformed other men and women of all races and classes, and the nation flocked to him, you know. Peter Howard also wrote plays. Here's one, a book, "Ideas Have Legs, How You Pass It on Personal Evangelism." They made a play out of this. They went all over the country and, you know, had professional actors and everything and sold tickets and the whole nine yards. And that play then gave the Oxford group philosophy. Here's a Frank Buchman at 80. When he turned 80, they produced a book, lots of pictures in here about Frank all over the world with members of the British Parliament and premiers in India and... gurus of everywhere and big names in the Philippines and all that sort. He ran with a real high class of folks. Here's Walter Houston Clark. Some of those pamphlets I was showing you there, he wrote some pamphlets for the Oxford group. Here's his book, "The Oxford Group, Its History and Significance."
Again, thanks to Peter and the New York connection, I just show up and these things just kind of boom. They have found a faith by Marcus Bach. He wrote a lot for Fillmore's Unity Church. We're going to get into Fillmore and Unity Church. Emmett Fox, I'll give you a short shot here. Emmett Fox, the Sermon on the Mount that he wrote and everything, he once made a remark. He said, I'm a spiritual child of Charles Fillmore, who started the Unity Church. Marcus Bach was a writer for the Unity. He just retired here a few months ago, as a matter of fact, for the Unity. He wrote about a lot of little-known religious groups in America. And in here he talks about the Oxford Group, and it parallels the Unity Church of today. We got, here's one. There were some few critical things written about the Oxford Group, too. Here's one by B.C. Plowright. Rebel religion.
Rebel. Oh, man.
Here's another one here by William C. Irvine. Heresies exposed. The exposure of some of the prevailing heresies of this day. And it really gets into the Oxford Group. It's very negative.
Pardon me. Can you give me that book number?
Yeah.
The name here. No, on that Unity.
On the Unity, yes. They have found a faith by Marcus Bach. Here's a magazine, November Forum. Let's see here, where is it? Bookmanism by E.W. Manville, Reviving Early Christianity. This is just one. There's hundreds of them out there. This was a real hot item for its day. Rising Tide. They even published... Here, I'm going to take this one out so you can kind of see it. This is a pictorial magazine. It's just full of pictures. The Oxford Group printed this, and it shows Bookman, and it shows all over the world, and they're in India, and they're in Sweden. Workers led by God can lead the world. Personal changing in your life. Here's, look at that, a whole page, all of the, just look at the people in that picture. Young Christian men on a mission.
When was it published?
Rising Tide came out. It's in the back here. Here's the Rising Tide, 61 Gramercy Park. See, we're right down Sam Shoemaker's neighborhood here. Oh, God, where is the date on that? I can't pull it right now. here on the back page is a literature list of books that you might want to write for the Oxford Group. Four Sinners Only by A.J. Russell, Life Began Yesterday by Stephen Foote, and I Was a Pagan by Walter Kitchen. the editor of this, the guy that put this together, as a matter of fact, Mel knows him real well, James, and he's still living.
And here's his book.
James Dean Newton. You want to talk about him?
Well, we're about ready to break here. I was just going to say I had a few, I discussed those pros and cons of the Oxford Group. And there were magazine articles that were critical. But in 1936, Bookman was a cover subject of Time magazine. And they had a big rally up in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And 10,000 people were up there in 1936 in the Berkshire Mountains. And my wife and I were in Stockbridge a year or two ago. We went there to see the Norman Rockwell Museum. And I can't imagine how 10,000 people ever came into that little town and stayed there. They must have slept in the parks or something. But Bill and Lois Wilson were among that 10,000 that went up there for that big rally. But imagine getting 10,000 people in 1936 in the heart of the Great American Depression up in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and that meeting was featured in Good Housekeeping magazine, a very positive article. So that was the Oxford Group. They attracted criticism. Usually whenever you saw the term Bookmanism, it was critical. Bookmanism, that was kind of a critical term. And I noticed most of the time when they referred to it. And one of the articles about AA, the doctor or somebody refers to Bill as having recovered through Bookmanism. It wasn't critical of Bill, but you had a feeling that the guy was critical of the Buchman program. But that was, you just have to look back at that and say that there was some great reason for all of that. And as far as we're concerned, you see, we can't be too critical of it ourselves, even though we've changed our program from what they were doing. But nevertheless, the thing that makes our movement work, we got from them. There's no question about it. And of course, my basic feeling is that that's first century Christianity. And that was when the AA program was first presented to these people around John D. Rockefeller, you know, one of the guys, Albert Scott, his first comment was, "Why, this is first century Christianity." That's what he said, you know. People really practice Christianity or some principles of it. It astonishes everybody. Still does, you know.
Here's a book in case you... Dick Burns has been really digging into the Oxford. He's bringing some stuff to light that's really unreal. You got to read it. The Oxford Group and Alcoholics Anonymous. He's made the connection here. I love this line here. The point of the Oxford Group and Alcoholics Anonymous is to bring new life to people. And Tex and I were talking a little bit last night. He hit it right. You know, we embellish all of this and pull it out and draw it in. The bottom line is so powerful, why screw it up? To bring new life to people. That's the connection. Dick Burns is his name. He lives out in Hawaii. He's got about five new books. He's really been getting into the Oxford Group. A lot of new stuff that's never been known before. The importance of the Oxford Group connection, how much we got from them. He's really bringing some new light.
Don had something back there.
Was Bill Wilson and Frank acquaintance? Did they know each other? I know that Bill sort of praised him in AA Comes of Age, whereas he didn't give him no recognition.
The question is, did Bill Wilson know Frank Buchman?
Well, when I asked Bill that, he just said, just to shake hands. Oh. And probably in a line, receiving line or something. But Buchman, I don't think, was mentioned in AA Comes of Age, but he was mentioned in Pass It On. Yeah. And it was quoted from a letter, and I dug that out of a letter. And I'm surprised that it survived. I thought it would get edited out, but it did survive. It's in the book.
My taper tells me we have under a minute here. We're going to...
It's time for a wee-wee break.
God bless you, Mal. I don't know. That might be an opinion. See you back here at 11 o'clock. What we use the word sponsor today is a completely different...
Now, I didn't understand once before when you're up the open meeting, George, you spoke about going into New York City. I misunderstood that about, and I was talking to Terry or Steve, I think, about, would you run through that again? Because you'd go in and see Bill or what?
No, my sponsor was old Bob, and he... Bob Levins was his name.
Oh, I know. That's...
That guy isn't that old.
No.
Bob Levins. He's dead now.
He's dead now.
I looked around after my first sponsor took me as far as he could. I looked around. I wanted an old buffalo who really knew his stuff. And I ran across this guy and started taking me meetings. And he started talking about Bill Wilson because he'd known him. And I'm a history teacher. I'm a natural sucker for this to begin with. Now I run across this guy and he's telling me stories about the founder and stuff. And one of those stories was how he used to get in the car back when he was sobering up in the, 40, 41, somewhere around in there. And he'd go down to New York City so he could talk with his sponsor once every 2 weeks, whether he needed that or not. And it's just a neat story to bring it in because John's here today. John graduated from treatment yesterday, as a matter of fact. I got this call on the telephone. It says, would you be my sponsor? They said I ought to have a sponsor, and I, of course, immediately thought of you. And I said, sure. Who the hell are you? And he said, I think you knew my dad. They nicknamed him Old Bob. And that's how this story, I can roll on to anywhere you want.
Hey, here we go again. We had a question on the original manuscript back there. Can you get those? Yes, there's reprints of them out there. All of the Salamander Press, the guys that put out this concordance to the big book, they've reprinted it. You can get one from GSO. You just send to Frank Mauser at the archives up there. I can give you the address if you're in. And they don't sell them. What is it? For a $15 donation, they'll send you. I've seen about 9 or 10 different folks that are reprinting that. Just come see me, and I'll get you a copy of that manuscript. Let's get the Oxford group developed, and then she kind of gets out of whack, and AA is going to say, oops, we need to break away.
But I was thinking we could talk about, I mentioned the two streams of the Oxford group that fed into AA, and the one was in New York, and of course we talked about Sam Shoemaker, and how his church there in New York became the U.S. headquarters.
Let me show this one here. This is I just got this. It's a letter by Frank Bookman, and it says, "Dear Miss Dr. McKenzie." Dr. McKenzie was he was one of his bosses. "I hope very much that some of your people can come to the house party, which has to do with the how of training people. It would be a joy to have you, too. The work is growing by leaps and bounds. We're going back to Providence, Rhode Island, tomorrow for the 50th time. Bishop Perry there has been most helpful and kind. The work has been vindicated in all sides. I'm grateful. There is an earlier house party for people who are just beginning to think of Christian things. With warmest regards, sincerely, Frank Bookman." So they had a house party to train the trainers. this was the North. Now, the important thing about this here, what we got here on the top of it, Bookman wanted to maintain warm relations with his old employer. Bookman held no ill will towards McKenzie. That's the one thing I want to point out. These parties were large and numerous. You could read in here maybe that Bookman might have been bragging somewhat to his old McKenzie there. A little ego there. The house parties concentrated on the how process that he started way back at those classes in 2021, 22. We showed you those flyers. Notice the letterhead. This is the biggie. It says up here, Calvary House, 61 Gramercy Park, North New York City, New York, March 1929. We've got a letter by Frank Bookman at Sam Shoemaker's church, using his letterhead and stationery. Sam said, "Come on into Calvary Church here. You can use it as your base." They had seven stories, I believe. There was a big, giant Calvary Church. There was Calvary Mission, where they worked down the mission. There was one next door to the church. I think it was a dormitory kind of thing for 400, street. Overnight to help the indigent kind of thing. There was the Calvary House, which was private offices and libraries, and Sam himself had the whole seventh floor, I believe it was. He said, "Come on up there, seventh floor, and we'll turn this into the world, the U.S. headquarters, the Oxford group, and you can operate out of here." And now we've got an actual letter by Bookman on Calvary Station.
Yeah, there was that. There's no question about it that Calvary Church was the headquarters, and that the Oxford Groupers practically took it over. And I've always had the impression that the Oxford Groupers, they were people doing good, but when they moved in on you, why, they kind of took over a little bit too. And I think this was part of this was involved in the final break between Shoemaker and Bookman, which came in 1941. But anyway, this was what I call the New York part of the Oxford group that fed into AA. Now, there was also an Akron part that started out in Akron. And through this man, Willard Hunter, that I've told you about, and also through Nell Wing, who was Bill Wilson's secretary for 20 years, and she later set up the AA archives, a wonderful woman, and not an alcoholic, but a woman who is just made AA her career. And I got in touch with a fellow named Jim Newton. And Jim lives in Fort Myers Beach, Florida, with his wife, Ellie. And they are both old-time Oxford groupers. And Ellie, her maiden name was Eleanor Ford, and she wrote one of those booklets about the Oxford Group, which you probably have.
Yes, and the Rising Tide magazine there, that was James D. Newton. He was the editor of that.
And incidentally, in On the Tail of a Comet, it tells about in the 1930s, when they were going to South Africa on a ship, and a fellow named McGee B. Was drunk all the time. He was in the Oxford Group team, but unfortunately his drinking problem was still active, and he was coming on to Ellie. This was before Jim and Ellie were married, but McGee was always coming on to Ellie there, and was a big problem to Bookman on that trip. And so years later, we find a letter to Bill Wilson from an AA member in Richmond, Virginia, and his name was McGee B., the guy who had been in the Oxford Group. And he was the one that asked Bill about the Oxford Group, and this is in Pass It On, where Bill lists all of his reasons for the breaking with the Oxford Group. It's in Pass It On. But the letter was from McGee, the same McGee that was in the Oxford Group in 1930 going to South Africa.
Even before there were 12 steps, he was working on the 13th.
Right. Well, a little bit. And when I mentioned this to my wife and I spent a whole afternoon with Jim and Ellie last year. They're just wonderful people. When I mentioned this about McGee, they wanted me to find out more about him, but so far I haven't. I was going to try to get in touch with some AA members in Richmond and track down whatever happened to him. But at that time, when he wrote to Bill and everything, he was very active in the early AA in the Richmond, Virginia. See, so there's all of these relationships and people involved with each other that keep popping up. But anyway, Jim Newton, when he was a very young fellow, he was a luggage salesman in the East. And one night he was staying at a tavern, a hotel. One weekend he was staying at a hotel in Massachusetts. And he saw rooms, a lot of pretty girls and young fellows in it. It looked like a dance or something they were having. And so he decided to go in there. And he thought it was a dance or something. And instead, it turned out to be a meeting of the Oxford Group. And that weekend changed his life. And so Jim tells about how he went back out and told one of his customers that he had cheated him or something like that. And then the customer wanted to know why he hadn't told him that before, and Jim says, well, I thought you'd lose respect for me, and the customer says, well, up until now I never had any respect for you. And he tells that on himself. But it just changed his life. And he was just a young man of 21 or 22, but a very gifted person, very talented. He's still living today. He's almost 90 now. And
I think I tried to call him just 2 days ago, 3 days ago, and in 40, all I'm getting is an answering machine. Jim and Ellie are not home. They're out on a vacation. How old has he got to be? And they're taking off, and they just go everywhere, just so full of life. And
wonderful people.
90.
Well, she's 92, and he's 90 or something like that.
Yeah. Right? Oh, God. They're just.
Let me finish my story about what happened to him. In 1928, he went to Akron as Harvey Firestone's assistant at the tire company, of course, and he had been introduced to Firestone by Thomas Edison. Well, now, I think there was something about Newton that he just makes friends wherever he goes, and his book here is about his acquaintanceship with five famous people, uncommon friends, and one of the things he says in here is that he never tried to use any of these friends for personal gain or anything like that. And I believe that's true. Here he rubbed elbows with these millionaires and famous people.
Henry Ford.
Oh, yeah, Henry Ford.
Charles Lindbergh.
And Edison.
Now, you said you thought possibly he was the Charles Lindbergh's
closest friend. I believe he was. Yeah, he was. In later years, he was Lindbergh's closest friend. And the only rift that I see that ever happened between them was when he tried to get Lindbergh into the Oxford Group, and Lindbergh resisted. And that was the only time their friendship was a little strained. But Lindbergh really trusted him, and they were good friends. And when we were there, one of Lindbergh's daughters had just been there. Jim had his cars out there. One was a brand new Cadillac, and then one was a slightly older Cadillac, and then one was another Cadillac. And I told Jim that if he wanted to put me in his will,
I would like to have that new Cadillac. And I say the wrong things once in a while, don't I? He told me that that other car, that the Lindbergh daughter used it when she came down to Fort Myers. It's the one that's written the book. I can't remember her name. But they are very close friends, and they have many prominent people all over the world that think a great deal of them. But anyway,
Harvey Firestone was so impressed by James Newton, he brought him up to Akron, and he was basically going to turn Firestone Company over to him. He had him all programmed and groomed to be the next leader. He wanted him bad.
Well, that's right. He was just a young fellow. He was only 23 when he started working for the Firestone Company, and he was handling all their real estate all over the country. But he became a close friend of Harvey's second oldest son, Russell. And Russell, he was a drunk.
Nicknamed Bud.
Bud, yeah, they called him Bud. And so Jim started working with, Jim thought the principals of the Oxford group would help Bud with his problem. And they'd go on trips, and they'd pray in the hotel room, and he said Bud's tears would just, they'd be kneeling by the bed, and Bud's tears would just wet the side of the bed and everything else. But there was no help. He just kept on drinking. And this was in Prohibition, remember. And then finally in 1931, they took a trip out to Denver. And there were Oxford group team members in the group. And on the way back from Denver, now Bud was carrying a flask on this trip, but Jim persuaded him to let him have the flask, and so he could kind of ration Bud's drinking.
Sam Shoemaker was on that train, too.
I was going to get to that. So on the way back, Bud and Sam Shoemaker went into a compartment to talk. And as they came out, Jim could see a change in Bud, something different in his face and everything else. And that was the beginning of Bud's sobriety. Now, I think he did have some trouble with drinking off and on later on, but I believe his life was changed from that point on. Well, he got back to Akron, and his dad was so excited, and everybody in Akron, they knew about his escapades and all of that. So a year and a half later, in early 1933, the senior Firestone sponsored a big Oxford group rally in Akron in January of 1933. And this was very important to AA's future, because we had the Henrietta Seiberling, the woman that introduced Bill and Dr. Bob, and we had the Williamses. They came into the Oxford group at that time. But this was a big rally. Hundreds of people attended. They had a big black tie affair and everything. And Bookman spoke before 100 ministers. And when the photo in the paper, I went over to Akron and looked at the newspapers for that weekend, and it shows Bookman getting off the train and being greeted by Dr. Walter Tunks, who was the minister that Bill Wilson called in 1935 when he came out there. See? So it's just a small world. Well, now this Akron stream with Sam Shoemaker and so on, you see, that got this fellowship going in Akron that was to be so important to Bill Wilson when he came out there. Bill Wilson, when he came out to Akron in 1935, he had only been in the Oxford group 6 months himself. But Dr. Bob, in his personal story, he tells about falling in with a group of people. He says shortly after the beer experiment, he'd had that beer experiment that you talked about, then he fell in with this group of people who attracted him because of their ease and all of that. He found out it was something of a spiritual nature, which he didn't like very much. But he went to their meetings for 2.5 years, but got tight every night nevertheless. So that preceded Bill's coming to Akron, all of that work, that Oxford group work out there. And that was very important. You see, the ground was tilled. Everything was prepared. And the people that were to help Dr. Bob and to get things off to a big start in Akron, which AA got off to a better start in Akron than it did in New York. See, they had all been conditioned by the Oxford group and this rally. You can take over now.
I want to go back to New York. The Oxford group is going to catch on. It's going to get so popular. Bookman is going to be out there speaking to thousands and thousands of people. And around the world, he's going to get talking to all the world leaders everywhere. Bookman realizes or gets guidance, however you want to look at that, let's move on from the personal individual evangelism of a person. Let's change the whole world. He even went over and had, at a point in time, was talking with Adolf Hitler before the war and everything.
Excuse me, he never actually had a chance to meet Adolf.
Oh, I thought...
He wanted to.
Oh, he was working on it.
Yeah. Oh, yes, he was. That was part of the... That kind of that 1936 interview and everything. We could talk about that a little bit.
Well, let's go ahead and do that now.
Okay. Well, Bookman loved to go over to Germany, and he was, Pennsylvania Dutch, and I think he'd even spoken German when he was growing up a little bit and all of that. So he had a great affinity for Germany, and he felt that if he could reach Hitler and convert him, then Hitler would turn all the German people around and we'd have world peace. You know, this was that key person strategy again. And I personally don't agree that it could have ever worked that way. But I think Hitler was telling the German people what they wanted to hear. And they were bitter, resentful people, disheartened and everything. And he came along and told them what they wanted to hear. And I think if he had changed his tune, they would have found another guy. That's my personal feeling. But that's opinion. I'll hold the sign up. And I don't think it's that simple. But it was part of the key person strategy. So then he had an interview with a writer from the New York Telegram in 1936. And in the process, he said something like, "I thank God for a man like Adolf Hitler," or something like that. It was in the interview, because Hitler had supposedly stopped communism, or was a bulwark against communism.
And think what the world could be under the leadership of a man like Adolf Hitler if he were to be directed by God. You know, if I could get to him, think of the possibility. But sometimes the press, doesn't get things quite right.
Well, when it came out in the newspaper, it had a spin on it, as we'd say today, "Thank God for Hitler," or something like that. 1936, when Nazism was just building up and everybody was getting to be concerned about it, he gives an interview, and that tainted the Oxford group and Bookman for the rest of his life a little bit. And he never really said he was wrong, but Willard Hunter told me that became their greatest problem, was that interview. Everybody, a few years ago, I stopped in the Cleveland Central office, and a new person had just started working in the Cleveland AA office. And I said, "How much do you know about the Oxford group?" And she said, "Weren't they Nazis or something?"
Ah.
You know what I mean? So that shows how these little things can get you in trouble.
You whisper to the guy on the end and say, "Mary wore a red dress on Thursday," and boom, now, gone.
Here was an office where they sell this absolute, the four absolutes, like George just showed you and everything. But she had this impression that the Oxford group were Nazis. Well, Bookman did have a great love for Germany and the German people. In fact, he died in Germany, in Freudenstadt, Germany, where he was walking in the forest when he got this idea in 1938 of the term moral rearmament. In 1938, he was walking around in the forest in Freudenstadt, Germany, and the rearmament was the talk of the times, Actually, the only country that was really rearming then was Germany. We were in the pit militarily, and the British weren't doing a very good job. And
that was the term thrown about at that time.
Yeah, everybody was talking about
rearmament, the war's coming, rearmament. And Bookman said, we don't need a military rearmament. We need, you can save all of that and the killing and the wars and the death if we have a moral rearmament. At the same time, he was already moving on to this world-saving attitude and everything, and then the problems with the Hitler remark and all, and he was guided then to change both the focus and direction of the Oxford group and also the name of the Oxford. Let's start again with let's launder it up and do it, and that's when it became Moral Rearmament,
MRA.
And the nickname is MRA. And it still is in existence. There are members of MRA today. They have a national headquarters in Washington, D.C. They have just recently, and they published not only this pamphlet here, if you want to know, like the old book, what is the Oxford Group? Well, here's the pamphlet, what is MRA today? It's printed by Moral Rearmament, a worldwide network of women and men who have started with themselves to bring the changes they want to see around them. It has always been a Christian-based interfaith work. Membership includes everyone willing to practice it. Measure how you are now living by the absolute moral standards of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. They're not goals you reach. They are signposts. Ask God's help to put right those things beyond your own power to change. Steps 6 and 7. Talk over matters with a trusted person. It's supported by the voluntary giving of those who believe in its effectiveness. Each person is responsible in teamwork with others to his or her conscience and inner voice. In the United States, there are 8 regional centers staffed by full-time workers with a main office in Washington, D.C., so you can see the primary goals, not the focus, but at least the primary goals, haven't changed in over 70 years. Here's a, this is a newsletter, this is just this, no, this is February's newsletter. There are folks who still belong to the Oxford Group, by the way. They may be a lot closer to you than you might realize.
Peter has a question.
I was up in Mackinac Island some years ago, and the hotel there called the Inns of the Mackinac, which is a rather big, bigger grand hotel, I think. And I thought it was rather strange. They had some murals on the wall that included Mahatma Gandhi and a lot of other world leaders, and I figure this is strange for a hotel, so I inquired, and I was given the impression that that was the last stand of the Moral Rearmament. Like, obviously it's moved on, but it was headquartered at Mackinac Island at one time. They had the biggest movie soundstage east of Hollywood in that end, and that's why they did the movie Somewhere in Time in Mackinac Island, and the movie people headquartered at Inns of the Mackinac to use all that equipment that the Moral Rearmament had left behind.
It was a headquarters for more when it became Moral Rearmament. It's strange you mentioned a picture of Gandhi up there, because I've got an article, is it, I don't think it brought, I think it came out of the Saturday Evening Post, and there's a picture of Gandhi there, and it says, "Why I Did Not Join the Oxford Group," and it blisters the Oxford Group. Strange you would mention Gandhi's pictures on their wall.
I forget who else is on the wall. It's a big mural up in the dining room.
Amazing.
There's a little story on that, Peter. I don't know when it happened, but maybe around 1970 or maybe the late 60s. The Moral Rearmament decided to start a college on Mackinac Island.
Maybe that was what that was.
And I think that those buildings were what they built for the college. And this broke the movement, trying to run this college and support it financially. Who wants to go to college up on Mackinac Island? You know, that you don't have any vehicles out there. It's very cold in the winter, and you have to get there by a ferry boat.
They don't allow any motorized vehicles on the island, and it's
I like that.
Yeah. Their main headquarters today, when they moved away from Mackinac Island, they do have, there are not any Oxford Group meeting, MRA meetings per se, where you go to like an AA meeting, but they do have an annual convention, I guess you would call it, a conference in Caux, Switzerland, and that's talked about in this particular, it's a monthly newsletter here, Breakthroughs. They also have a news magazine that you get if you send them donations. They say there are no membership rules. I'm in MRA, okay? I'm an Oxford grouper of the present day MRA. You send them a donation. There are no membership lists or fees. If you believe the way we do and wish to change your life, you are a member. Yeah? The only requirement for membership is a desire to change your life, all right? Okay. And you send them some money and you get on their newsletter list and everything. Several informational pamphlets they still put out, and a wide variety of books. You can still get them through Grosvenor Pub, Salem, Oregon. T. Willard Hunter, your friend T. Willard Hunter, the old-time Oxford grouper, he's written a book very recently, A.A. and the... Oh, what's the title of it? Doggone it.
Well, there is... he did a booklet, yeah.
Yeah.
AAA and the Oxford Group Connection. Is it over there? Maybe we didn't bring it. Grosvenor Books publishes that. And so they haven't gone away.
Now, Don had a question back there.
Yeah, basically, I thought the Moral Rearmament book was centered in Switzerland. But then you say they have a convention.
They have a big, beautiful hotel over there on the lake. And
Swiss Chalet kind of a...
Yeah, that's where they meet every summer. And the Newtons, Jim and Ellie Newton, still go over there. And Willard Hunter and those people. You know, there's a small world thing here again. In the 1950s, I used to do a lot of prison meetings in Michigan, at the Jackson Prison and other places. And they always talked about a guy in the correction system that worked for the state of Michigan named Bob Scott. And everybody would praise this man about what a great guy he was, what a humanitarian guy he was, and working with young offenders and everything. Well, then years later, when I was doing this, working on Pass It On, somebody gave me the name of a professor at Michigan State that I ought to interview, and his name was Bob Scott, and he was a professor of jurisprudence, the same Bob Scott. And so I went over to Michigan State and interviewed him, and he had been in the Oxford Group since 1936, and he was a young lawyer back there and troubled in his life, and he had joined the Oxford Group, and at that first Oxford Group meeting he attended in Williamston, Massachusetts, Roland Hazard was there. Now, Roland Hazard is an important guy in our story. We ought to get to him in a moment. But he told me about this, how they went in, and then they all knelt down, and he talked about himself. And anyway, that was kind of his commitment to the Oxford Group, and that had governed his whole life ever since then. Now, I had known none of those things in the 50s when I heard all from other AA members, you know, about what a terrific guy this Bob Scott was. And that was in 80 or 81 that I interviewed him. And then some years later, I tried to get in touch with him, and by this time he was in a nursing home and unable to talk to anybody. And I assume that by now he's probably gone on. But that was another one of these small world stories, you see. And so there were three men that I knew that were old Oxford Groupers, not alcoholics, Willard Hunter, Jim Newton, and Bob Scott, and they were all terrific people, which we have to attribute, you know, to the influence that these Oxford Group principals had on their lives. Go ahead.
Just some kind of general points here. By 1941, this focus of the Oxford Group is going to be on worldwide changing instead of people changing. They're going to... Sam Shoemaker at Calvary Church, this is a big, big church, major church in downtown. And the whole basement is taken over by their literature department, and people selling this stuff all just as fast as they could shovel it out the door. Frank is up there on the seventh floor taking over the whole floor and, you know, writing letters and talking to people and planning trips. And well, the vestrymen at Calvary Church come up to Sam and say, "Hey, Sam, you know, this is an Episcopal church. We need to start paying attention to our ministry here. It's all very neat stuff, but a lot of our time, our resources in time and money, we need to take a look at this." And then Shoemaker takes a look at the thing and says, "Yeah, worldwide changing maybe has gone a little too far here." He talks about the problem with Frank Bookman, and Frank Bookman says, "Hey, I'm God-directed. You do your thing. I'm going on to do my thing." There was a meeting arranged. Who was it told me? Was it James Newton? They tried to make a reconciliation out of Lake Tahoe. And Shoemaker did show up, and Bookman did show up, and they talked. But what Shoemaker ran into was this: "I'm God-directed. You do your thing. I'm going to do God's thing." And there was to be no reconciliation.